The return of our favorite car experts. We've already seen snow in some parts of Maine. Have you put on your snow tires? Do you even have them? Wondering if you really need them? Well, that's the kind of question you can ask today as John Paul of AAA Northeast and Jamie Page Deaton of U.S. News & World Report are back to talk cars, trucks, and SUVs. I'm Jennifer Rooks. If you are in the market for a new car, Jamie and John have some great ideas. We'll also discuss some of the automotive news of late, from airbag recalls to the discontinuation of the VW Beetle to potential new rules about the brightness of headlights. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Wintry weather is on its way. Is your car ready? Our automotive experts join us today to talk about winter driving as well as the latest news from the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs. Joining me from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Jamie Page Deaton, who is U.S. News & World Report automotive editor. And on the line from the offices of AAA Northeast is master mechanic and AAA car doctor, John Paul. As always, we want to hear from you. Were you surprised or sad to hear that the Volkswagen is halting production of the Beetle? Do you have questions about hybrids or electric cars? What do you want to know about snow tires? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to both of you. It's been a while, and it's so nice to have you back on Maine Calling. As always, I start by asking each of you what you've been driving, knowing that you get to try just about anything out there for a week or two at a time. Jamie Page, what have you been driving lately, and did you like it?
I just got back from the North American Car and Truck of the Year test event, which was awesome because I got to test things back to back to back. And so while I have not been in it for a week yet, I was really impressed with the Jaguar I-Pace, which is their all-electric SUV. It's a direct competitor for the Tesla Model X. And frankly, it is excellent. Great one-pedal driving, handles more like a car than an SUV in that it's very low, very planted. Because it's an electric car, it's got a lot of torque on demand, which means you can just take off right away from a stoplight. And again, because of the way it's constructed, these electric cars, they have just such great balance. And it was so exciting for me because, I like cars that do well regardless of their propulsion system. And electric cars have had like a lot of compromises that you have to make. But Jaguar's got this with a range of over 250 miles, and it drives great. And so it's really, to me, bringing in kind of this. It's heralding, all right, this is a mass market electric SUV. Everybody can get behind it. And now we're really at the cusp of bringing more cars like that to market. So that was one that I'm really excited about.
The Jaguar I-Pace, what does it sell for, Jamie?
Well, the one I drove there's always that. It is a Jaguar. The one that I drove was as tested at $93,000. But one that's related to that, though, or kind of related or still another EV, is the Hyundai Kona EV, which is not available in all 50 states yet. They're going to roll it out slowly over the next year. That one retailed, I think the one I tested was about $34,000. And that was an EV that was also just excellent. Of course, a lot smaller and not quite as sporty as the Jaguar. But the Kona is a subcompact SUV that Hyundai's put out, and it's a good SUV. But when you make it the Kona EV, all of the compromises that you have with the Kona kind of go away. It's a lot quieter. There's, because of the different balance that you have with the battery pack and the motor as opposed to the gasoline engine, it feels more planted. It's a little bit more upscale, better put together. So, yes, like the Jaguar I-Pace, it's great. It's leading edge. But you also have these more affordable EVs coming in right after it, which is why I really feel like, all right, we're at the tipping point of mass market, affordable EVs for everybody. And that to me is just awesome to see. It's exciting to be covering this industry at a point where we're seeing such rapid development. I mean, it really hasn't been this much change in the industry since really the car was invented. So wow. That's what I'm excited about.
John, what about you? What have you been driving lately and how do you like it?
Well, nothing quite as exciting as a $100,000 electric car. And I have to agree with Jamie. I think, you know, the turn of the last century in the early 1900s, when you went out to buy a car, you could buy an electric car, you could buy a gasoline car, you could buy a diesel car, you could buy one that, I don't know, probably ran on wood chips or manure or who knows what they ran on. But that's what made it really interesting. I think now we're seeing the same thing where something like the Hyundai Kona, you can buy in a gasoline car, you can buy it in a hybrid, you can buy it in a fully electric car. But the car I've been driving lately is a new little car from Nissan called the Kicks. And it's a little front-wheel drive only subcompact SUV. It seats, it has seatbelts for five people. It seats more like four. It's powered by not the most powerful engine in the world, a little 125 horsepower engine. But it's a neat little car. It's got interesting style and even more interesting paint. The one I'm driving it's painted kind of a two-tone with an orange roof. Really a little bit of a standout kind of car. Fuel economy, 36 miles per gallon, so great fuel economy, easy to drive, small but yet pretty roomy. It has pretty decent room behind the back seat. You fold the seats down and it's a lot more spacious if you need to carry something big and roomy. What's also nice about it too, you kind of get an idea who it was marketed to. There's USB ports all over this thing, 12-volt power points, lots of bins and cubbies. It's got Apple CarPlay as standard equipment. And starting price, around $16,500, I guess. Even fully loaded, the one that I drove was about $21,000. So if you're somebody who doesn't need all-wheel drive, but you still want that utility of a sport utility vehicle, be able to carry stuff around, but still want to get really good gas mileage, Nissan Kicks is certainly worth a look.
Wow, new vehicles on the market. It's so interesting. I want to talk about a couple of studies that have come out recently, some data that's interesting. Jamie, I'm going to start with you. A new Edmunds report talks about that the average used car is now more than $20,000. Holy cow.
Yeah, used car prices have really, really gone up. I mean, and this is tracking with new car prices as well. I mean, don't forget that the average price of a new car is over $37,000 now. But what's really interesting, I think, and what's going to be interesting for a lot of used car buyers is not only that price has gone up, but the share of the market of used cars that are under $10,000 is just 16%. Now, 5 years ago, used cars under $10,000 were 25% of the market. And now the average used car payment, according to Edmunds, is over $400 a month. So whereas you used to go to used cars to save some money, you know, that's not always the case. And what to me is really interesting is, you know, you talk about something like the Nissan Kicks, which John is testing. You know, it starts at $16,500, and you know that's well under the average price for a used car. So as consumers move towards more expensive used cars, and that's largely due to the fact of consumers choosing and preferring large SUVs now, you know, those are just more expensive as new cars, so they're going to be more expensive as used cars. But, you know, you could actually save a little bit of money by going for something smaller and get a new car compared to shopping used.
Yeah, and it sounds like for many models, a lease on a new car may be more affordable than buying a used car.
Yeah, you do have to be careful with that, though, because, you know, if you buy a good, reliable used car, yes, your monthly payment might be higher, but it's going to end at a certain point in time. If you lease a car, you will always have that monthly payment. You know, you'll have one for 3 years and then you get a new one for another 3 years and it never really ends. The other risk that kind of comes with leasing and something that might be impacting the average monthly payment for used cars is really to get a good deal on a lease and to make leasing affordable, you need to have top tier credit. And if you don't have that top tier credit score, you're not going to get a good deal on a lease. And in fact, you may not qualify for a lease at all. And so that's something, too, is just to take the study finding from Edmunds of the average used car payment being over $400 a month for the first time. That has not only to do with the fact that used cars are more expensive, but also interest rates are rising. And used car buyers tend to have lower credit ratings than new car buyers, which, of course, is going to give them higher interest rates, which is going to push up their monthly payment as well. So it's an interesting indicator of what's going on in the used car market, but you've got to keep all these other factors in mind.
All right. Well, speaking of new studies, John Paul, AAA has been doing some studying of the, I guess they're called advanced driver assistance systems. This is what we see advertised, cars that will automatically stop if somebody crosses a sidewalk in front of them, or beep when you're drifting over a lane. But there's some, you know, there's a lot of pros to these, but there's some cons as well. Yes.
Oh, there's a variety of things. In fact, one of the things we look at is repairability. How much are these systems going to cost to repair when they become damaged? And it could be something as simple as a windshield. There's so much technology built into windshields today and behind the windshield, cameras and sensors and so forth. And you have to make sure that once that windshield gets replaced, that technology is going to be as good as it was prior to any kind of crash or incident that happened. The other thing that we found out is that sometimes some drivers are over-relying on this technology. And believe me, I think everybody who buys a new car should try to buy it with as much technology, safety technology in it as possible. But keep in mind, it's only as good as the conditions around it sometimes. So there's no substitute for a well-engaged driver, somebody who's paying attention when behind the wheel. That's your really your only job when you're driving is just to stay engaged and pay attention. That sometimes doesn't always happen. And sometimes what will happen is people will rely on some of this technology. And some of it, for instance, like lane departure technology, where you start to drift out of the lane and the car may signal that you're drifting out of the lane, or it may actually recenter the car back into the lane. And we look at that kind of technology, and that what happens is, and we've done some video studies, when people have this technology in the car, they set it up, they put the smart cruise control on, and that's when all of a sudden they suddenly look at their phone and check their email. And that's not when you want to do it, because that technology is only going to work until it can't anymore. And that could be a rainstorm, it could be a variety of different things that could shut the system down. And you as a driver need to jump in and be ready to take over. And the same thing happens. Well, there's another issue that happens too, and that is that vehicle manufacturers have a lot of different names for this technology, and it's very confusing to the buyer. In a lot of cases, more people are spending time with how to sync up their cell phone rather than, you know, all this technology and what it can do for you in the car. And that's one of the problems that happens too. So we really encourage people when they're out car shopping, really look into the technology, but find out what its limitations are. Some of this automatic emergency vehicle braking, really all it does is slow down the car. Other people think it's going to stop the car. And in some cases, that doesn't. When we did our testing, we actually had a remote control foam full-size car. And we got pretty good at reassembling it when cars ran into it.
Oh, my. Let's talk about some of the other news out there. Jamie, what is General Motors up to when it comes to emissions?
So General Motors has proposed a sales mandate for emission-free vehicles, which is, you know, kind of fits into what we've been talking a little bit about with the EVs. But basically, you know, GM is one of the first automakers to come out and say, hey, we think the government should be setting a standard that says, you know, X percentage of your sales need to be on, you know, coming from vehicles that are emission-free. Now, whether anything will actually come of it, I mean, let's be honest, you know, given the current political climate, it's unlikely that there's going to be any sort of mandate. But it's still nice to see a large automaker again coming out and saying, you know what, we've got the technology, we have the ability to do this, but what's missing is kind of consumer demand. And so GM is really looking at ways to kind of juice that a little bit and to get other automakers on board with selling more of these electric vehicles and other low emissions and emission-free vehicles.
And John, something else I read just this morning is that some federal agencies are taking a look at headlights and how they're regulated, and that maybe we won't soon be blinded by headlights that, you know, sort of have that blue glow.
Well, it's sort of funny. It's, you know, safety-wise, the more light that's on the road, the safer you are. There's no question about that. In fact, a lot of cars today, if you're driving, say, more than 40 miles an hour on an unlit road, your headlights on low beams don't illuminate far enough down the road to where your car is going to be in a matter of seconds. So better headlights are really something we need to look at. We're a little bit hampered by some older laws that keep headlight development kind of held down a little bit. In Europe, they have these fantastic headlight systems. All this technology starts on more expensive cars. But on Audi, it's a series of small lights that circulate around where you think the headlight would be. And then if you're in the approaching car, it shuts off segments of the light, so you still have lots of light on the road in front of you, lots of light to the right-hand side of the road, but the car coming in the opposite direction, the lights are shut off, so you're not blinded by the light. So you're still being able to see really well. You're not blinding other drivers. The problem is that type of headlight doesn't fit into the headlight laws that we have in the United States because the laws are frankly a little bit archaic. So the other thing is some of these high intensity discharge lights, the ones with the kind of bluish white tinge to them sometimes, the problem is people have replaced the headlights in their cars with cars that simulate that. In a lot of cases, those high performance bulbs are not legal for on-road use. So you might see a 15-year-old Honda Civic drive by with really bright headlights. You go, geez, what's that all about? Well, if you were able to look at the bulbs that were installed, they may say for novelty purposes only or not for on-road use, and people are able to put that in. So I think as we see new car headlight development start to change, we're going to have better lighting on the road, safer cars on the road, and especially one of the things is between the time we're 20 years old and the time we're 60 years old, we need three times as much light to see. So when you're behind the wheel of the car, you want good light. You want to be able to see. You want to be able to be out and be able to see the roads clearly. And changing the headlight laws is a big step in that direction.
All right. And Jamie, I want to talk about GM again. We were talking about their emissions, call for zero emissions cars. But also, I've just read an article that General Motors is offering voluntary buyouts to 18,000 employees, confirming the plans is a proactive measure to address future headwinds. This comes right after Ford Motor Company announced that it's going to reduce its workforce by 70,000 worldwide. What's going on with Ford and GM?
Well, I think it's important to look at where these buyouts and these layoffs are coming from and what divisions they're in. If you see, these are actually impacting a lot of kind of white collar workers and things like that. And it's really just a shift from these companies moving from kind of the traditional automaker to more of a mobility focused company. Both Ford and GM have recently announced that they've bought stakes or ownership in scooter companies, the little electric scooters that people take, kind of from their apartment, maybe to the subway station, and it's a subscription service. And so these companies are finding, that they have to diversify their business. Most analysts and many, economists are predicting that car ownership is going to change, and what we think about car ownership is going to change. Now, I always think that needs to come with a big caveat, where, in Maine or in New Hampshire, or even, here in Iowa, there's just not those mobility solutions that where you can easily give up car ownership. And, speaking as a parent, I need I want my own car because I've got car seats to haul around in it and things like that. I don't want to be, shifting to a subscription-based service where I've got, a different car every afternoon. But the automakers are anticipating that there are going to be some major shifts in the market, where people who in the past would have bought cars and had a traditional ownership experience are moving to using more public transit, using a subscription service, using a car sharing service, or using different means of getting around, maybe electric bicycle, electric scooter, something like that. So they're trying to prepare for that future, because it's very important to remember that automakers in particular to look very, very far ahead, and they have to structure their workforce and their manufacturing facilities very far ahead. I mean, it takes about 7 years to develop a new car. And so when you're talking about a totally new business model, as well as some of the headwinds that they're facing, whether it comes from, tariffs or, just general global, shifts in the global economy, they need to be prepared for it. And so they're trying to get a little bit lighter, a little bit leaner. And honestly, too, this, no doubt pleases their shareholders a little bit as well. But this is really about preparing for kind of the next wave in mobility, which is not going to be built on the back of, the single family car.
All right. Well, on that note, we do have to take a quick break. We'll get to your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the World Affairs Council of Maine, engaging and educating people of all ages to become global citizens. Learn more at wacmaine.org. and Martins Point Healthcare, dedicated to providing the highest quality care and coverage to the people of Maine and New Hampshire, offering Generations Advantage, the only Medicare Advantage plan ranked 5 stars by Medicare in the state. Learn how you can enroll at generationsadvantage.com.
It's been 40 years since cult leader Jim Jones told his followers to drink poison. 900 Americans died, and a young congressional aide named Jackie Speer was shot trying to help victims escape. Today, she helps represent the city shaken by these murders. Congresswoman Jackie Speer on Surviving Jonestown. Next time on 1A.
And you can join us for 1A this evening at 9 o'clock.
There you are.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was outside just sitting in the car listening to the radio.
Oh, another one of those driveway moments.
Yeah, but not exactly what you think.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, Public Radio's got a fundraiser coming up.
Yeah, sure. Super Thursday. Well, I knew it was coming sometime.
That's what I was listening to. They're actually talking about it.
So?
Well, you know how everybody loves the one day, the Super Thursday thing.
Of course. What about it?
Apparently, that has not been working as well as we all thought.
Really?
Yeah, they say they do raise the support that's needed, but you know how they've been talking about new members a lot lately?
Yeah, they have.
Well, apparently that's the part that hasn't been working. They say not enough new listeners are joining in, and they also say the one-day campaign makes it easy for folks who might support them to ignore everything.
Are you saying they're going back to days and days and days?
Well, yes and no. This coming campaign will be a 3-day event so that they can make sure that potential new supporters really hear those messages over and over a few times. And hopefully jump in with the rest of us.
I guess that makes sense, but I've really come to love the one-day thing. We've been lucky.
Well, we have been, but the one-day event isn't going away. This one will be 3 days, and importantly, it may not be all that bad because they're saying as soon as those new member goals, along with the dollar goals, of course, are met, they'll shut the whole thing down, so it may not be that bad or last that long after all.
I hope so.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest in the automotive world and answers to your car and truck questions. Joining me, Jamie Page Deaton, automotive editor for U.S. News and World Report, and John Paul, AAA car doctor and master mechanic. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with Larry, who posted on Facebook. The first one, I'm going to follow up with a question of my own, but it's kind of funny. He says, a simple one. Why the bleep can't studded tires be re-studded? It seems like a total ripoff that my snow tires, with plenty of tread for snow, can't be re-studded to deal with ice. So, John Paul, what's your answer to Larry's question?
Well, it's pretty hard. What happens is the machine that studs a tire, the stud looks a little bit like, if you could imagine, a 1/3 size roofing nail. So sort of a big head on it with a metal part at the end. And what happens is when the stud is installed, there's a little hole in the tire. The hole is spread open, the stud's pushed in, and then the hole seals around the stud. So because of that, it needs to be a brand new tire. It needs to be good and clean so the studs can be installed properly. Anybody who's ever gotten a set of snow tires and decided that they didn't want the studs and they stood there for 3 hours trying to pull the studs out, know that that's pretty difficult to do too. So it's just not practical to be able to do that. It's not, even though the studs may look like they're completely worn out, they're still actually doing a little bit of job when the weight of the car's on them. So if you're driving on a really clean, flat road and you have studded snow tires on your car and you still hear kind of a tick, 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 tick noise as the tire is rolling, the studs are going to still work. They don't have to look like spikes sticking out of the car. They're still going to work. They're still going to be able to do their job. And being able to restud a tire just isn't practical. I don't think you could do it even if you had enough technology and money and time to be able to do it. So when they eventually wear out, time for new ones, but that's about it.
And John, I'll follow up with a question from a coworker. As I was walking into the studio for the program, he wanted to know, do you recommend studded tires?
If you live on the top of a glacier, I think they're a good idea. But if you're somebody who doesn't, you know, let's face it, we drive on wet roads, dry roads, and maybe occasionally snowy roads, a whole lot more than we drive on icy roads. So there's a bit of a compromise with studded snow tires. They don't work as well on dry roads as they do on icy roads. So because of that, there is a bit of a compromise. A better solution is a true winter tire or a winter ice tire. And those are tires that don't have studs, but what they do have is a softer rubber compound that's actually almost sticky in cold weather, and they'll give you the better traction in the winter time. The downside of those, like, you know, everything has a plus and a minus. The downside of those is they tend to wear a little bit more quickly. So where you might normally get 5 or 6 years out of a set of snow tires, when you put 4 snow tires on your car and take them off in the spring, you might only get a couple of good years out of a winter ice tire, and then they turn into sort of conventional winter tires at that point. Good in the snow, not as good in the ice. So it really depends on your driving. For most of us that don't need to be out before the snow plows and the sanders, a good set of winter tires usually does the job. But if you're somebody that needs to be out bright and early, or if you, like I said, you drive on a particular roadway that always gets icy, then maybe you might want to consider old-fashioned traditional studded snow tires. But for most of us, they're a little bit of an overkill.
And finally, with one quick question, John, when do you recommend putting on the snow tires? I know that I often wait until there's a snowstorm in the forecast, and I have a feeling mechanics aren't crazy about people like me.
Well, because you are not the only one who does that. And, you know, usually it's a good idea. You know, we can have, you know, I live closer to Boston, and I remember we had a pretty devastating snowstorm a few years ago right after Halloween. In fact, I think Halloween was on a Wednesday or Thursday, and we had a foot of snow on Saturday. So it's really hard to say. I like to tell people, when you're getting your car ready for that winter maintenance, you know, do that oil change, check all the vital fluids, do all of that. So it's probably going to be the middle to late October is a good time to do it. We like to think October is car care month. That's the time you really look at your car for the winter weather and all the work that it's going to need to do over the winter time. So if you are somebody who puts 4 snow tires in it, and I want to say 4, it's very important to put 4 winter tires on. If you're somebody who does do that, probably doing it sometime in the month of October is money well spent, and you won't be waiting in line to do it you know, the first or the second maybe snowstorm that happens in November or December.
So if you haven't done it yet, now. And Jamie, I'm going to give you Larry's second.
That's good time. And you know, pick a beautiful day to do it. You know, a day where everybody's thinking about maybe raking leaves or, you know, going out to get that last ice cream of the season. That's probably a good time to go, you know, put your winter tires on.
All right. And the second question, Jamie, I'm going to give this to you. This is also from Larry on Facebook. My current clunker has to be retired, and I'm looking for a replacement. I have a budget of between $8,000 and $12,000. Obviously, cheaper is preferable, and I want a small SUV. I'm looking for a vehicle that's 4-wheel drive or a 2-wheel drive that can deal with Maine winters. Any suggestions on a make, model, and maybe a year? For what it's worth, I see a lot of satisfied Subaru owners.
Yeah, and there's a reason, Larry, that you see a lot of satisfied Subaru owners. As we talked about, it's going to be tough to find something in that $8,000 to $12,000 range, particularly because if you're looking at, you know, a smaller SUV like a Subaru Forester or maybe a Honda CR-V, both of which would be excellent choices. You're going to be looking at something older if you want to spend between $8,000 to $12,000, because those are in pretty high demand now. If you go for something a little bit smaller, like maybe a Jeep Renegade or a Honda HR-V, you'll be able to save a little bit of money. But the main thing to remember here is, you know, you're going to, for that amount of money in a very popular class of car, you're going to have to go for an older used car, which is going to mean increased maintenance costs, which is going to mean, you know, you're going to lack some of the newer safety features. So one of the things that you might want to consider, if you're not married to the idea of a small SUV, is getting a small sedan with all-wheel drive, like a Subaru Impreza, which you can get with a hatchback. So it gives you almost SUV-like cargo carrying ability. But because it's in a class of cars that really nobody's shopping at the moment, you can get a much better deal. If you also look at sedans with four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, the Ford Fusion has available all-wheel drive and would be fine, you know, for most Maine winters. So that's another way to save some money. And if you're looking to save money on a car and you're not, you can go beyond what's popular right now and go for a body style that's maybe a little bit different than what everybody else is currently shopping, you can save big time. But again, like if you really need a small SUV in that $8,000 to $12,000 range, older models of the Honda CR-V are a great option. Older Subaru Foresters and Subaru Outbacks are great options as well.
All right. Well, we'll go to Christina, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. This year, I purchased a Prius Prime, and I'm very pleased with it. Since I drive it primarily in electric mode, I'm getting a little concerned about the gas in the tank getting old. Could you tell me what you think of that? I've researched it and haven't been able to find any answers.
That's right. And John, while you answer her question, explain why she's asking it. If people don't know what a Prius Prime or other models like that, how they operate.
A Prius Prime is a plug-in battery electric car. It has a battery that will give some amount of limited range. I think in the Prime, it's up to 25 miles. So depending on how you drive, and I have a coworker who has one, and he lives about 7 or 8 miles from work. We have a charging station here at work. So pretty much the gasoline engine almost never runs. And the concern is what can happen to gasoline when it sits and sits and sits and sits and it can go stale. Most battery electric hybrids will have a time during the run cycle while the car is on that it will actually kick on the gasoline engine to burn through some of the fuel that's in the car. I just recently looked at the Mitsubishi plug-in electric hybrid, and it has a system that forces the engine to do that periodically to use some of the fuel in the fuel tank. If it were my car, what I would do is add some sort of fuel stabilizer to the car. And there's a couple of brand names out there. Stabil is one, S-T-A-B-I-L. And what it does is prevents the gasoline and the additives in the gasoline from separating out. And it also protects against excessive moisture contamination. So it's the same sort of stuff if you have a gas can, a lawnmower, or a snowblower, or a lawn tractor, or garden tractor. You put in the gas to keep from going bad. Adding that to the gasoline in a plug-in electric hybrid is a good idea. Also, the same thing you need to think about with the Prime is, even though the gasoline engine doesn't run very often, there's still oil in the gasoline engine. And I think the maintenance indicator will tell you when you should change the oil. But if I owned a battery electric hybrid, I would probably still want to change the oil once a year to make sure there was fresh oil in there for the times you're going to need it. And in the wintertime, chances are you're probably going to start the car up once in a while and let it run, even though it can be plugged in to do that. But still, there's times that you might want to warm the car up a little bit. Maybe you're not near a place where the car is plugged in. So the gasoline engine is going to run. Idling is not the best time for a gasoline engine. So changing the oil once a year, adding a gas additive to the fuel tank will keep that fuel from going bad.
Christina, thanks for your call. I'm sure others had the same question. We'll also go to another call from Falmouth. This is Sydney. Hi, Sydney. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah.
Great. So I'm actually in my brand new Chevy Bolt right now that I leased a few months ago. I've always driven European cars, Mercedes, Porsche, Subaru, and this car is fantastic. I'm so enthusiastic. I'm on my way down to see my mom. She lives in Massachusetts. And on a full charge, I get like 220, between 220, 250 miles, depending on how I drive. So my question, I guess, is I just don't see any marketing around these fantastic cars. I think Chevy is missing the boat. I bought it because of, you know, it seems like the right thing to do for the planet. But this car is just terrific. I mean, I just love driving it.
Well, Sydney, thanks for calling and sharing your experience. Jamie, we were talking about electric cars earlier. What about Sydney's point that we don't see these marketed hard?
Good reason for that, and that's because car companies want to make money, and you know they ain't UNICEF, and so the problem that they're facing is consumers just don't care. Gas is really ridiculously cheap for historical standards at the moment, which means that it's not all that much more expensive to go buy, you know, a big SUV, and that's what people are buying, and so that's what they're going to put their dollars into. But, you know, I agree with Sydney. This is really a missed opportunity. And, you know, it is important to note that the Bolt as a Chevrolet is a General Motors product. So that is part of their portfolio that they're pushing with to say, hey, there needs to be a government mandated sales level for these types of cars. Because, and, you know, they're saying that because they've really been on the leading edge of the development of, you know, electric cars. And that's very strange to say, to think about, you know, Chevrolet, because most consumers, when they think about Chevrolet, they think big trucks, they think big SUVs. But the fact of the matter is Chevy has one of the best electric cars on the market in the Bolt. And the other thing that Chevy and other brands that are developing EVs are really running up against is the fact that there's a very large elephant in the room around electric cars, and that's Tesla. And most consumers who are thinking electric cars think Tesla, and they don't really think about Chevrolet. Just a little anecdote, you know, I have friend who drives a Tesla, and he was really into getting an EV. And at the time that he bought his options were the Model S from Tesla, the Bolt from Chevy, or the Nissan Leaf. And he really wanted the Tesla for that brand recognition, even though the Bolt was much less expensive. Because again, he felt that if he bought the Bolt, he would be kind of supporting a brand that had pushed a lot of large trucks and SUVs on the planet, you know, with a lot of their poor emissions. And so it's, you know, something that Chevy is trying to fix. But Sydney's right. They haven't put the full muscle of their marketing department behind it. And a lot of that just has to do with consumer desire. Until consumers come out with, you know, until they start kind of crying for these cars, which in a lot of cases, what we're looking at is by the time people want electric cars, it's going to be too late for a lot of the planet. But until there's consumer demand there, you're not going to see automakers investing a lot of their marketing into those cars.
Sydney, thanks so much for your call. Jamie, it's interesting you say with gas so inexpensive. The reality is, though, still filling up an SUV tank, even with the price of gas today, is going to cost you $40, $50, or $60. Is that not significant to many consumers? It is to me.
It's not, I know it is to me too. But if you think about it, you know, if you look at how much more that an electric car costs compared to a comparable gasoline car, I mean, if you look at a Bolt, which costs around $37,000, and then you compare it to, you know, another compact kind of car, which costs maybe around $20,000, there's a $17,000 difference there. That's a lot of fill-ups that it's going to take in order to hit, you know, in order to break even on your decision to buy the Bolt there. The other thing to think about, too, is, you know, when you're talking about most electric cars, like the Bolt or like the Kona EV that I was talking about, the I-Pace is a little bit different because, again, that's kind of a lifestyle signifier in that it's a Jaguar. So setting that one aside, you know, the Bolt is competing against cars like, say, you know, the Mazda CX-3 that gets very good fuel economy, or going up against a Subaru Impreza, which can get 42 miles to the gallon. So most people aren't cross-shopping the Bolt with the Suburban. And they're finding that if they opt for, say, the RAV4 over the Bolt, it's not that much more expensive to, you know, it's not that much more expensive to run. And given the higher price of the Bolt, which of course translates into much higher monthly payments, that is what's making it, you know, the kind of driving the economic decision behind the choice to go for the gasoline car.
Sure, but aren't federal rebates really bringing the price of electric cars down? One of my coworkers just got more than $7,000 taken off the price of her car.
Yeah, but there's still, that is a good point, but those automakers are running out of those. There's only a certain number of those that are available for each automaker. I think it's on the first, you know, 200,000 or so models that they sell. The other thing is you have to have a high enough tax burden to get that tax break. And then you also have to do a little bit of, I mean, when automakers talk about like, oh, you can get, you know, $7,000 back from the federal government when you buy this car, they're doing a little bit of accounting sleight of hand, because it comes, you get the break on your taxes. So you still pay the full price of the car. And of course, for most people, that means financing the full price of the car. But then you get that tax break. So you have to kind of be able to hold on until, you know, April when you get your tax refund back. And not a lot of people are able to do that. And, you know, you end up kind of paying interest on whatever you financed on the car. So, yeah, there are some incentives available. In addition to the federal incentives, a lot of state and localities gives incentives as well. But it's still a little bit, you know, complex. And there are a lot of factors that you have to take into account that aren't necessarily making these cars, you know, a better deal. I mean, you can $37,000 Bolt or the $34,000 Kona EV, or you can look at the, you know, $16,500 Nissan Kicks that John was talking about. And you kind of look at that, and economically speaking, while it's not the best choice for the planet, for your wallet, the Kicks might be a better choice.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break. But first, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about the modern funeral and how traditional funeral practices are changing. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Otelco, formerly OTT Communications. From phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century, otelco.com. And UMaine's Framing Maine series with Paul Dworin and Kristen Lindquist in conversation with Monica Wood, Thursday in Orono. Free tickets at Framing Maine.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. The news is often confusing, but not always. On 1A, we tell it like it is. We ask the tough questions and bring in guests that can shed light on the issues at hand. We are honored to be heard now on Maine Public Radio, Monday through Thursday nights at 9, just after Maine Calling. We'll have those important conversations about the hard stuff and the stuff with heart. We'll bring context and we'll make connections by listening to you. Join us for 1A, weeknights at 9, Monday through Thursday, here on Maine Public Radio.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for Ideas from the CBC. Today's program, Taming the Beast, Are Violent Urges Part of Men's Nature? That's Ideas from the CBC coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, our car experts, Jamie Page Deaton with U.S. News and World Report and John Paul with AAA Northeast. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Going to an email now from Ted. I was recently in a minor accident. Someone ran a stop sign and I broadsided them. I drive an older Honda and it tore off my front bumper. When I reported this to my insurance company, they asked if the airbags had deployed. They had not. In getting estimates from the two garages, I asked them why they had not. They both responded that they had seen vehicles with extensive damage with no deployment and vehicles with slight damage when all or most of the airbags deployed. They didn't have an answer as to the discrepancy. Do your guests have an answer? John, do you know why?
Yeah, it takes three things for an airbag to deploy. It takes the collision, but it also, and it takes speed, and it takes the force behind it all. So it's, and part of that has to do with the angle. So chances are, as the person went through the stop sign, there wasn't the G-force that would be involved in, say, hitting a tree, for instance, and, you know, having that total impact that happens. There's various crash sensors in the car, and a lot of times you can see some very extensive damage and not see an airbag deployment because the G-forces weren't there to fire off that last signal that needs to be done. So it's speed. Speed is part of it. Low speed, you won't get anything that will happen during a low speed collision, because you don't want to, if you hit a parking lot bumper, you don't want the airbag to go off. So speed is one of the things, but also the angle of the crash is also very, very important, because if you sideswipe something, what happens is the G-forces of the crash get ridden down through the car, so you don't have that big impact. And realistically, not having the airbag going off, chances are there wasn't any injury involved. If the airbag went off, if they weren't wearing their seatbelt, for instance, because an airbag's a supplemental restraint device, they could have been injured. But there's also the cost involved. So at the end of the day, this may have also been a cost saving. So again, there's a lot of reasons airbags go off. Sometimes they go off in small, what looks like a small collision because of the speed is 15 or 20 miles an hour, but it's a hard hit at 15 or 20 miles an hour versus a side swipe or where this car went through the stop sign and tore off the front bumper of the car. It wasn't enough to actually set the airbag off. Television shows a lot of airbag deployments, especially in different movies where a car will be parked and it will get hit and the airbag will go off. That doesn't happen in real life. In real life, it takes those three factors for the airbag to deploy.
All right, we'll go to Paolo calling from West Bath. Hi, Paolo. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for your kindness. I hope this question is within the scope of the program. It might not be of interest to many of your listeners, but I cannot figure out why excise tax are so high on some old cars that are not collector's items and don't have high value. Three, 4 years ago, I bought a almost 30 years old BMW 850i, which is a 12-cylinder car. But I couldn't get any more than $10,000 for it, which I paid. I paid $10,000 for it. And they want $400 plus or minus $1.
Okay, John Paul, you're not I know you're not an expert on Maine's excise tax, but maybe generally speaking, how are excise taxes figured out by state governments?
Excise taxes are figured out on a ratio of the value of the vehicle. And there is sometimes you can, if you think the excise tax is totally out of whack, you can go talk to your tax office and say, you know, I don't understand how this is based. But where I live in Massachusetts, it's based on I think it's $7.50 per $1,000 worth of valuation. And what happens is the numbers change pretty dramatically from brand new, where you get taxed a lot, to after a couple of years, and then there's a minimum tax. And my car I had prior to the one I have now, I think I was paying only about $50 a year for the excise tax versus when it was new, it was probably close to $800 or $900 for the excise tax because of the value. BMW 850 is a luxury car, but is it a luxury car that, you know, sells for more than $10,000 or $15,000? Maybe not. So I would go and ask the question, where did this value come from and how did it get determined? And based on that, they may say, you know what, you're right. The tax rate is too high on this particular vehicle. Just like the same thing can happen with taxes on houses. When they do an evaluation, sometimes it's not always correct. And this could be the case in this car.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Paola. Paolo, excuse me. I want to go next to James in Wiscasset. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. You were talking earlier about the Volkswagen discontinuing the Bug. A little while back, they had talked about introducing an all-electric bus. I'm wondering if anyone there knows what's happening with that.
Jamie?
Yeah, this is it's the VW Buzz ID. It is so cool. It looks like the VW bus from the 60s, a little bit updated. It's all electric, and this is something that Volkswagen is planning to bring to market, I think, in either 2020 or 2021. And it's one of those things too where it just looks like it expands the EV market to a wider audience, because it should be able to seat, I think they're looking at, up to 7 people, which would be great. You know, all of a sudden you have, if you have a larger family or you're routinely driving carpool, you have an electric car option. just have to say, too, that it looks so, so cool. It reminds me of, you know, those old VW vans now that are really popular, you know, with people doing yoga on Instagram. All of a sudden now they're going to have this great EV option for all their Instagram posts. But it looks to be a really practical EV. And VW, I think, should they bring it to market and they stick close to the concept, which is the ID Buzz, if you want to go Google it and look at pictures of it. Then, you know, I think they could potentially have a real winner on their hands. But it is, I think, one of those EVs that just might be worth waiting for.
All right. Well, James, thanks for your question. Related question. Norma on Facebook says, I'm considering getting an all-electric car. Is it practical in Maine winters and no garage? I'm on my second Prius. Thoughts? Somebody without a garage.
Yeah, that is one of the things because, again, we've done some testing. And in cold weather, it's not unusual to lose about 10% of the range, but when you run the climate control system, we've seen some testing. We tested a Leaf, a Chevrolet Bolt, and I believe a Tesla. And when we did some testing in, it was on a dynamometer in a dyno room, so sort of think of a treadmill sort of thing, in a special climate control room where we could bring the temperature to about 20 degrees, or we could raise it up to 115 degrees. And when we chilled the temperature down to 20 degrees, oh, we saw about a 10% or so depreciation in the range. Then what happened was when we ran the climate control in that same cold environment, we saw the range drop about 40%. So we saw a really dramatic change in how that car would perform in really cold weather with the heat on, which is why so many electric cars let you precondition the cabin while the car is still plugged in. So, you know, one of the other issues, not having a garage, and I don't have a garage, and I test electric cars from time to time, is you go to plug it in, and whether you have a dedicated charging station at your house or you just have a big old electric plug that you plug it into, the plug can be affected by moisture and rain and snow. And if you have a foot of snow overnight and you have your cord out and the cord gets in such a situation that it gets damp enough, it can trip the circuit breaker. Where I plug an electric car in, I do it as a convenience plug, so typical house current. And I've had times where it's rained really hard overnight and it's tripped the ground fault breaker, which is, you know, which protects a person from getting electrocuted. But all of a sudden you think your car, you know, charged up for 7 or 8 hours overnight and come to find out it tripped within the first hour or so of its charging because it rained really hard. So those are some things you need to consider if you want an electric car and you don't have a place to charge it up. That can be a problem.
Okay, Melissa on Facebook wants to know when the Ford Escape hybrid plug-in is coming. Jamie, do you know?
I don't know, not off the top of my head.
Okay.
But I would say, you know, that's something that they're working on probably within the next couple of years because these plug-in hybrids are just, I mean, lately they're like the rabbits of the automotive industry. They're coming out of everywhere. So even if you don't want to wait for the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid, there are plenty of other ones to choose
from. Okay, and we have just a few seconds left, but I want to ask Annie's question on Facebook to you, John. She says, I've always wondered where the temperature sensor is that tells me the outside temp when I'm in the car. It can't be in the sun or too close to the motor to give an accurate reading. Where do manufacturers put those things?
Well, it is a lot of times in the sun, but it's compensated for that. It uses a light sensor to know that. So in a lot of cases, it really is right behind the windshield or somewhere located in the car, because occasionally you'll see some and it won't regulate properly because
of
the
heat
temp. Inside.
Where's the one for the outside air?
Yeah,
temp?
Well, that's what I mean.
Oh,
no,
inside,
I know for the outside. Sometimes it is. So it can be sometimes, but it's compensated. The other time is as part of the emission control system. So it knows the temperature of the air coming into the intake of the engine. So it uses that same reference point. So that cool air coming in while you're driving is part of it. And there's a bunch of algorithms that take place that do all the magic math that make it all happen.
Thank you, guys. As always, Jamie Page Deaton, U.S. News and World Report's automotive editor, and John Paul, master mechanic with AAA Northeast. John Keimel ran the board. We're produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Pond. Han, I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.